Did you know that your gut is directly connected to your brain and can contribute to anxiety, stress, and depression, which, by the way, can also impact your sexual health? So here's my secret weapon for gut health, Just Thrive Probiotic. Now listen up. Just Thrive isn't just any ordinary probiotic. It is the only one that survives your stomach acid and reaches your gut 100% alive. All those others, the ones that come in fancy drinks or you gotta refrigerate, nope, that's not even a thing. This is the one. I've noticed significant changes to my overall health. Like, this might be TMI, but I'm way more regular and my skin is glowing. Think of Just Thrive like your personal gut gardener. It maintains the health of your gut by weeding out the bad bacteria that causes all those digestive issues and then replenishes the good, making it a total game changer for your digestion, your immune system, your skin, even your mood and sexual health. And if you want to check out my episode with Just Thrive's founder, Tina Anderson, we talk all about how gut bacteria plays a crucial role in your overall happiness, including your sex life. Because a healthy, balanced gut means less stress and more energy. So if you want to check it out, I'm offering a deal for my listeners. You can save 20% off site-wide at justthrivehealth.com with the promo code SEXWITHEMILY. That's 20% off on the probiotic that's truly changing lives and making waves in the wellness community. Everyone's talking about it. Don't just take my word for it. Try it for yourself. Go to justthrivehealth.com. Use promo code SEXWITHEMILY for 20% off. Thanks for listening to Sex with Emily. On today's show, I'm joined by Dr. Justin Lehmiller, a leading expert on human sexuality, to talk about his book, Tell Me What You Want, The Science of Sexual Desire and How It Can Help You Improve Your Sex Life. Topics include why we have sexual fantasies and what they mean, why you're totally normal and it's okay to have them, and the benefits of sharing them with a partner, what your fantasies say about your personality, the differences and similarities between men and women, and why it's so much better to talk about or act out our desires than to repress them. All this and more. Thanks for listening.
Look into his eyes. They're the eyes of a man obsessed by sex. Eyes that mock our sacred institutions. Bedroom eyes, they call them in a bygone day.
Hey, Emily, you got a boyfriend?
Because my man E here, he just got his heart broken. He thinks you're kind of cute.
A girl's got to have her standards. Oh, my.
Do women know about shrinkage?
Isn't it common knowledge?
What do you mean, like laundry? It shrinks?
Can we not talk about sex so much?
Are you kidding me?
Oh, my God, I feel so good.
Being bad feels pretty good.
But you know, Emily's not the kind of girl you just play with.
You're listening to Sex with Emily. We're talking about sex, relationships, and everything in between. If you want to know more about Sex with Emily, check out our blogs, our site. It's at sexwithemily.com. You can find us wherever you're listening to podcasts these days, Spotify, Google Play, iHeartRadio, everywhere. We love when you comment and subscribe on iTunes. That's awesome. And you can also find us on social media. It's at Sex with Emily across the board, Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And you guys, I have an exciting, really exciting announcement coming up. So stay tuned. I'll be making this announcement in the next 10 days. So check back. You'll be hearing it in a podcast. And today's show, I'm really excited. So it's all about you and your fantasies. So a lot of you ask me about sexual fantasies. And it wasn't until I even started studying sex that I realized the importance of fantasies. People who fantasize more have healthier, more satisfying sex lives. And, you know, we have them, we require them, but we so often repress them. But why are they so misunderstood if we all have them? Another interesting thing is the fantasies we have are pretty similar. In fact, there's only like three categories of fantasies. And get this, many of us want to enact them or talk about them, but we can't. Whether it's our own shame and guilt or fear of judgment from our partners, we just hold on to them. So that's why I was so excited to have my guest on the show. Dr. Justin Lehmiller is a leading expert on human sexuality and an author. He offers an unprecedented look at sexual fantasy based on the most comprehensive scientific survey ever undertaken. He looks at what Americans really want when it comes to sex and can we really get what we want? Okay, so you guys, for this study, he interviewed 4,000 Americans from all walks of life answering questions of unusual scope, and they really get into it. I really love this book because he got so granular on our fantasies. Tell Me What You Want offers looks into our fantasy worlds, what they reveal about us, helps readers understand their own sexual desires, and how to get them in their relationships. And also, how do we appreciate the desires of our partners when they might be different from our own? The bottom line is when we really understand human sexual desire and why it exists, we can truly experience less anxiety, stress, shame, and judgments around our own fantasies. So when you listen to this interview, you read the book, it's really going to give you that permission. I think a lot of us just want permission to know that we're normal and it's okay to talk about things. So we cover a lot in this interview, and I really think it's going to answer a lot of questions you might have and some you never even thought about. But once you hear it, you'll be like, oh, that makes sense. Now I get why I fantasize about that or why that triggered me. Here's some things we get into. Sexual fantasies, why we have them, and why it's so important to understand them and what they actually are. Differences between men and women, and a lot on how we're actually the same. Forget that whole men are from Mars, women from Venus stuff. And what's so appealing about BDSM, multiple partners, and sexual variety? These are three categories that we fantasize about the most. Ways you can tell your partner about your fantasies, compromises you can make so you can act on your desires, and the health benefits of actually doing so. We also get into open relationships. Dr. Leigh Miller has done a lot of studies on non-monogamy and open relationships, and also the common misconceptions people have about them. So I really think you're going to get a lot out of this interview. I certainly did, and I hope you check out his book as well, Tell Me What You Want, The Science of Sexual Desire and How It Can Help You Improve Your Sex Life. So enjoy the show. Dr. Justin Leigh Miller, you're a renowned sex educator, and I've been familiar with your work for years. I'm always reading your quotes and your articles, your stories, your books, and I'm curious. So of all the things you study, you know, sex is this huge swath. I mean, there's so many places to go deep. And so today we're talking about your book, Tell Me What You Want, The Science of Sexual Desire and How It Can Help You Improve Your Sex Life, which I just found absolutely fascinating. I couldn't put it down. But I'm curious, why did it seem so important to go deep on fantasies? Like, how did you know, like, this is the book? Because you did, you know, an impressive study of so many people. So what was that like, that process?
Yeah, there were a few reasons I decided to write this book. I've had an interest in the topic of sexual fantasies for a long time as a sex educator. And I wrote a textbook on human sexuality a couple of years ago where I had to review all the literature on sexual fantasies. And in the process of reading up on what's out there, I just kept coming up with question after question that had never really been answered before. And so I just started compiling this whole list of questions and decided to conduct this big study to help us learn more about the subject of sexual fantasies. And as I started talking to people about, you know, the study I was planning on doing, people seemed really interested in the subject. And I thought that rather than, you know, doing this as a series of academic papers, writing it up as a book for the general public seemed like a good way to go, because I think a lot of us have these questions and concerns about whether our fantasies are normal and what we should do about them, how to talk about them. So I wanted to kind of give people the tools to be able to answer those questions.
Did you get your questions answered? You said there were so many not answered. I feel like a lot of them were answered in this book. Tell me what you found that maybe to be the most fascinating research or things that you were like, I never thought this would be why we fantasize. Or, you know, was there anything that sticks out to you, or a few things that you were like, I couldn't believe we found this data after 4,000 people talking to 4,000 Americans?
Yeah, there were a lot of things that surprised me. I think one was, you know, sort of looking at gender and sexual fantasies and finding that women's fantasies were much more adventuresome and men's fantasies had much more emotional content in them than gender stereotypes would lead us to believe. I also thought it was really interesting to look at the way that people saw themselves in their sexual fantasies. You know, that's not something that's really been explored in previous research. And I find that most of us are fantasizing about changing ourselves in some way in our sexual fantasies, whether it's changing our body or our personality or our age. And those changes are revealing of aspects of our personality and how we feel about ourselves. More broadly, I find that there are these big connections between people's personalities and sexual histories and what it is that they're fantasizing about. So I thought it was really fascinating how our sexual fantasies seem to say something very unique about us, how we feel about ourselves, where we are in our lives at any given moment. Women were more likely to see themselves as the object of desire right. in their fantasy, whereas men were seeing themselves as acting on their object of desire.
Yeah, can you explain that?
Mm-hmm. One thing that sort of revealed this in my data was when I asked people, you know, how important is fantasizing about another specific person to you in terms of, you know, what that does for your arousal level. And I find that men are much more likely to say that having a specific person in mind is really important for the arousal factor in their fantasies, whereas women were less likely to say that. So for men, having a very specific person in mind was important, whereas for women less so, because in their fantasies, women are more of this seeing themselves as the object of desire, and they're a central focus and feature of the fantasy itself.
Yeah, I found that just so interesting that we were like, no, it's okay, whoever it is, it's kind of a blank face. I've heard that from women too. Like, I don't really know. It was a combination of people, but we were on the beach and it was, right. Their waves were rolling in, but I don't know who was there, but it just, that location felt. So I thought that was just so, that was really interesting. Why are these fantasies so important? Before you answer that, so on my show, I've been doing this for 13 years, and I get emails all the time, right? People want to know, and overall, let's just say most questions, which you could probably agree is, am I normal? People want to know, like, is it okay that sometimes I want sex with someone else besides my partner? Is it okay that I masturbate, you know, to something? People just want to know if they're normal. So this breaks it down. I think there's so much misunderstood about fantasies, and there is so much shame around it. There's so much, you know, trauma, and people just don't want to share it. What I love about this is you really talk about the importance of fantasy, and that it's actually just generally that it's an important part of being healthy sexually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly. And I think, you know, studying fantasies is important for a lot of reasons. One is exactly what you just said about people are carrying around a lot of guilt and shame and embarrassment. And by helping to normalize our fantasies, we can make it easier for people to talk about them with their partners and maybe even act on some of them. And that can help us to achieve more satisfying relationships and sex lives. But studying our fantasies is also really interesting too, just to help us better understand ourselves. I think our fantasies in a lot of ways are therapeutic. They're ways that we sort of try to deal with issues that we're facing in our lives. And in our fantasies, it seems they change as we age and as our psychological needs are changing. Our fantasies change to reflect those needs. Right. So our fantasies just tell us something important about who we are.
So why is it really important to kind of act on our fantasies and not repress them and not decide like, yeah, I've got this fantasy, but I don't want to tell anyone. Like, so why is it important for us to understand this and to act on it?
So we know there's a lot of research in social psychology showing that when people try to suppress uncomfortable thoughts or thoughts they don't want to have, that doesn't turn out well. And it ends up creating this sort of obsessive preoccupation where you end up thinking about it even more, and that becomes distressing and can be harmful to your mental health. So this is true, you know, whether it's a sexual thought or non-sexual, suppressing it isn't a healthy way of dealing with it. Instead, by coming to terms with our fantasies, sharing them with our partners, and acting on some of them, the ones that are safe, sane, and consensual, we have the potential to become closer to our partners by, you know, revealing these desires that we've never shared with anyone else before. Mm-hmm. We also have the potential to amp up our arousal in ways that we may have never experienced before. So it can really help lay the basis for more satisfying and passionate sexual and romantic relationships.
And I love that the book, that you really give that permission to people. Mm-hmm. Like, you really are like, it's okay. Like, we, like, first let's figure out what they are. Here's what I love, how you break it down, because we could probably start there. It's like, what are the common types of fantasies? And then we can get into like how we can kind of figure out what our own are and why it's okay. So what are the, you found like, I know there was 3 categories and 7 general fantasies. So whatever is easier here. There's so many things to talk about.
I know.
There's lots of back here.
There were 3 categories of fantasies that almost everyone reported having. These were multi-partner sex. So that's having sex with multiple people at the same time, most commonly in the form of a threesome, but some people were fantasizing about larger groups than that. And, you know, this is something that, you know, 80-90% of men and women reported having fantasized about before. And for many people, it was their favorite fantasy of all time. Mm-hmm. The second category that was really popular was what I term power, control, and rough sex. So that was really more about general themes of BDSM. And that can range from mild to wild. But again, this was something that the vast majority of people across gender or sexual orientation reported having fantasized about before. And then the other really big category was what I call sort of novelty, adventure, and variety, mm-hmm. which is about taking your sex life in just new and interesting directions for you, you know, mixing it up in some way, such as trying a new position, having sex in a new setting, just amping up that novelty factor in right. some way.
It's so interesting because I just feel like this is gives so much permission because we hear all the time, like, you know, I so much want couples to understand and people to understand that this is going to happen in your relationship. It's going to get dull over time. Things are going to happen and you're going to want that variety. So to see that people are actually fantasizing about it in a healthy way, but maybe repressing it, I'd love that you break this all down and give people like permission. I love what you did with BDSM because BDSM is kind of a rough sex, you know, it's kind of played throughout the book. And I found you had some interesting points there about that a lot of time for people who are not as focused maybe or maybe have more, it can be actually a practice that takes us out of our head because we're so distracted about sex. We obsess about other things. Am I doing it right? And being involved in like a power play, you kind of quells that. Is that
right? And
I found that, yeah, like, that makes so much sense.
That's part of the appeal of BDSM is that it can create this state of what some researchers refer to as mindfulness, where it sort of brings you into the here and now. It sort of centers you. It takes you out of your head. And I think ultimately that's what a lot of us are looking for in our sexual fantasies is, you know, we want to escape all of the insecurities, anxieties, and distractions that normally plague us when we start thinking about sex, and it might interfere with our actual sexual enjoyment. So by fantasizing about something that can help to really amp up the arousal level and put us in the moment, we can actually cope with insecurities in a way that we might otherwise have a really difficult time dealing with.
Right. I think that's it's so true. That was just an interesting angle to it. I mean, I thought that in my head. I'm like, that makes so much sense. But to see this in your research was fascinating. And then also the thing about BDSM I thought was interesting is that obviously more women want to be submissive in a BDSM right. fantasy. I think that BDSM can be very misunderstood, right? Like 50 Shades of Grey, poorly written book. A lot of people are like, oh my God, I couldn't get past the grammar. But when we get into it, we know why. It was a huge book for internationally. But it's interesting because you're like, well, I don't want to be beaten. Like that would really, you know, pain. That doesn't interesting to me. But a lot of the women actually said, I want it to be restrained, but I don't necessarily want pain. Like I don't want to be hurt too much. And I thought that was an interesting distinction to make because a lot of people are still very confused by what that actually means.
Right, and that's something that can vary from one person to the next. You know, sort of pain or, you know, domination, submission within very controlled limits. And people were very explicit about that when describing these fantasies. It's sort of just the right amount. And that's one of the things that I think can make this fantasy a little bit challenging for people to act out is to sort of communicate to your partner exactly what your comfort level and boundaries are. And that's why it's so important if you're thinking about acting on your fantasies, no matter what they are, that you have excellent sexual communication with your partner to ensure that those boundaries are very clear cut and spelled out and so that they know them and are respectful of them.
Yeah, I love that you really break it down and like, okay, so because here's how you figure out your fantasies are and then here's how you actually go about communicating about your fantasies. And so I'm curious though with this one, I think that's a really interesting question that people always like, I get it, I know my fantasy, but what's that next step? Like how do I actually get into this with my partner? Because even BDSM, they might say, oh, I want you to tie me up and then their partner's going, I don't know what that means, I don't know how to do it. So how do you kind of get people over that threshold?
Yeah, it takes practice.
Yeah, right?
It starts first with, you know, sort of just getting comfortable communicating about your desires with your partner. So you have to establish that level of sexual communication up front. And you can do this in a lot of different ways, but just start to have conversations about what it is that turns you on. And then, you know, it's really taking baby steps from there. This can involve, you know, maybe doing a little bit of background research, you know, when it's something like BDSM, maybe reading up on, you know, BDSM guidebooks, mm-hmm. but staying away from 50 Shades, you know, and other sort of fictionalized accounts that aren't meant to be a how-to
right.
guide.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. What do you recommend? Yeah. Is there a good book or what's your favorite book on it or your favorite way for people to learn? Because I get asked this a lot. I just thought, you know, you might have a place we could go.
In terms of BDSM guidebooks in particular, I don't have one that's immediately coming to mind off the top of my head.
I'm just curious if you have anything.
There is one that I do recommend for people with multi-partner fantasies.
Yeah, tell me.
Non-monogamy
fantasies. That's my next question. Let's talk about that. Perfect.
Sure. So it's a book called The Ethical Slut.
And,
you know, it's sort of this guidebook that introduces people to, you know, different types of relationships and kind of some of the considerations they might need to keep in mind. There are actually lots of really good guidebooks for people who are interested in exploring non-monogamy. Another one is called Opening Up that I know many of my sex therapists friends recommend to clients.
Tristan Taramino, that's a great book. Yes, I agree. So let's talk about non-monogamy and opening up in relationships, because tell me what you found in your studies, in your research here. Because I've been talking about this for years, that people are so afraid it could tear everything apart, but you actually had some people who were like, we've been doing it and it works and it's healthy. And I love that research. I love hearing about that, you know, because I think it is. I think that people are so terrified, and you had some good research in there about it.
Yeah, and that's actually one of the things that I found really surprising was when I looked at, you know, people who had acted out their sexual fantasies, what were their rates of success?
Right.
And I found that for people who were acting on consensual non-monogamy fantasies, meaning, you know, they're having some type of open relationship, or they're swinging or cuckolding or, you know, practicing polyamory, the vast majority of those people reported positive experiences that ended up improving their relationship. So it was actually somewhere around 90% or so people who enacted on their non-monogamy fantasies who reported those very positive experiences. There is an interesting distinction, though, between, you know, these sort of open relationship type fantasies in people who have the multi-partner or group sex fantasies.
Right.
The group fantasies were less likely to turn out well.
Right.
So, you know, when you're trying to manage multiple people in a group at the same time, that just seems to be a more complex thing for people to navigate. I think because many of us just don't have a script for how a group sex scenario should
exactly.
go.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We're trying to figure out, I don't even like group dinners and I don't know who's coming. Like group sex would be like I'm like, oh my God, who are these people? I found that to be, I agree with that distinction. I was like, that is fascinating and it makes so much sense. I thought it was also interesting. You talk about how the whole men are from Mars, women are from Venus in the 90s. I mean, I remember that. Like it was, you know, it was huge. And people are still like, you know, men are from Mars, women are from Venus. But I think it's so much, it's so far from the truth, right? So you kind of talk about that we have more in common than we think sexually.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, certainly there are some gender differences when it comes to the, you know, how often men have certain fantasies and women have certain fantasies. But for the most part, we're all fantasizing about the same sorts of things. And I think that, you know, when you're talking about heterosexual couples and relationships, that's a good thing in the sense that we have a lot more in common than we might think we do. So that suggests that, you know, there might be lots of potentially unexplored ways you and your partner could go about taking your sex life in exciting directions.
Right, exactly. Because you just don't know until you try. And I found it was interesting, too, that a lot of people say that they haven't talked to their partner yet, but they think they're going to be okay about it. They think my partner will accept me, but my partner accept this. But we just can't, like, rip the Band-Aid off and say, babe, let's talk about our sex life. And it's just so hard to get to there. And even though the data is showing it's going to be good, which is why I think everyone should check out your book, Tell Me What You Want. I thought this was The Science of Sexual Desire, How It Can Help Improve Your Sex Life. Like giving, it just gives permission. So,
right. And I think that, you know, the fact that people are saying, I think my partner would be okay with this, but I can't bring myself to tell them, really speaks to the amount of shame and guilt that a lot of us have about our sexual fantasies and desires and just the general discomfort we have when it comes to talking about sex, because we do a very poor job, especially in the United States, in terms of sex education and teaching people how to communicate about sex. The only communication skill we tend to teach people is just say no, and that's not a very valuable resource when it comes to, you know, having a healthy sex life with a romantic partner. How do you communicate about desire if you've never been taught how to do that,
right?
And you have all of this shame you're carrying around?
Exactly. We've never been taught anything. So how are we ever going to broach this thing of fantasies, which are still really misunderstood? I hope you're enjoying this interview with Dr. Justin Lehmiller. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, more on sexual fantasies. There's nothing quite like sinking your teeth into a good sandwich. But listen, carb guilt is real. I'm someone who's very invested in my health, and I like to get my carbs from oats and beans and fruits and not bread. But I love bread. So here's my hack. Thanks to Hero Bread, you can enjoy your favorite bready delights without the carb consequences. Hero Bread has turned those carby, empty calorie bread products into fluffy, delicious breads that boast 0 to 1 net carbs per serving, 0 grams of sugar, and are packed with loads of fiber and protein. The first time I tried their white bread, I was skeptical. Could it really taste good with such impressive nutritional stats? Well, I'm pleasantly surprised to say it absolutely does. The texture is just phenomenal. It's like this soft, airy, and it just toasts up like a dream. I've whipped up everything from grilled cheese to PB&J and even made enchiladas, wraps, and tacos with their tortillas. Each time, Hero Bread has been a game changer. And here's the kicker. Despite its light texture and great taste, Hero Bread fits perfectly into my health goals. It's been adding more fiber to my diet while keeping the sugar at bay. Whether I'm packing a picnic lunch, planning a road trip snack, which I often do, or prepping French toast for breakfast, Hero Bread is my go-to. So whether you're craving a classic sandwich, a burger, or a hearty bun, or even indulging in a low net carb croissant, Hero Bread is something for everyone. And I highly recommend checking their monthly small batch drops out so you can try goodies like the 1 gram net carb Hero Cheddar Biscuit and so much more. You won't believe what they have. So you ready to kick carb guilt to the curb? Head over to hero.co and snag 10% off your order with the code Emily. That's Emily at hero.co. So let's talk about the health of sharing fantasies. Let's also talk about, does everyone have, first of all, why do we have these fantasies? Does everyone have them? Like, I feel like I had to learn to have fantasies. But people, you know, it's like, oh God, I should, you know, I think I was really anxious growing up. I didn't have them. So I'm like, let me try to get, but why do we have them really? And where do they come from? Huge question.
So almost everyone has sexual fantasies. In my work, I found that it was about 97-98% of people who reported having them. And that's consistent with what we see in the broader research on sex fantasies. In terms of why we have them, there are a lot of different reasons. Our fantasies, most obviously, are a tool that we use to increase arousal. So we might use it while we're masturbating or during a partnered activity. We might use our fantasy to maintain a high arousal level. But we also use our fantasies for psychological escape, you know, for mm-hmm. distraction, to, you know, just give us something else to focus on. Right. So sometimes people fantasize simply because they're bored and they want something to do. You know, we fantasize for a number of different reasons. I talk about this a bit in the book, but they seem to be part of a healthy sex life and relationship.
Right. I guess for people listening, like if you're thinking about it, kind of build it out with your partner, talk about it, think about when you're masturbating, kind of think about what those themes are. And then, you know, think about like what you'd like to, because there are fantasies that we don't want to happen, that we wouldn't actually like to happen in real life. But even with those, if you share with your partner different bits and pieces, you can kind of piece together, create your own fantasies together. Like if your partner wants a threesome and you don't, right, you could watch threesome porn, you could talk through it, dirty talk. I mean, there's other ways, just because, yeah, I don't want people to be shut down by their fantasy, knowing that we could kind of compromise with your partner and maybe make a new fantasy together.
Right. And I think that's, you know, that's a key point, is that there's a distinction between a sexual fantasy and a sexual desire.
Right.
And you can fantasize about something and the thought of it really turns you on, but maybe you don't actually want to do it. And that's fine. But also there may be cases where you have a fantasy that is a desire, but your partner doesn't share that desire. And I think you give great suggestions for kind of, you know, alternative ways you can fulfill that fantasy. It's also good to know that most of us have multiple different fantasies. And so if you and your partner aren't a match on one of them, odds are there's probably some other fantasy where you are a match, and that you can potentially find fulfillment by acting on that instead. So right. There are all kinds of ways you can go when you start sharing your fantasies with your partner.
What is it about our brains, though? Like, we think we have to hide our fantasies, right? Because of guilt or shame or trauma. And how do we get past these own, like, self-judgments? If people are listening going, oh, yeah, that sounds great for everyone else, but there's no way I can tell my partner. She's going to leave me, or, you know, he's going to, like, you know, we're never going to have sex again. Like, how do we, like, what is that personal journey to accepting ourselves? Because that's kind of what has to happen first.
Yeah, there's a couple parts to it. One is you have to feel good about yourself first before you can go sharing your fantasies and desires with your partner. So part of this is just sort of the process of self-acceptance. And that's something that I try to do in the book by, as you say, you know, sort of giving permission to say it's okay if you have these fantasies, because most other people do too. And in fact, sex therapists find often that just giving their clients permission is enough to solve a lot of sexual problems. So starting there with that self-acceptance is key. And then from there, it's building that communication with your partner and taking baby steps. You know, if your fantasy is group sex, you know, maybe you don't want to come out and lead with that, because it can make some people feel threatened if you're talking about opening up your relationship or adding new partners into the mix. So think of this as, when you're sharing fantasies, it's a self-disclosure process where you start low, go slow, and gradually build up the intensity over time.
Right.
So work up to it.
Exactly. Don't just say, hey, babe, gangbang fantasy Saturday night.
Right.
Like, no, right? You've got to be like,
not
so.
The best idea. Yeah.
No, not the best idea. Like, let's talk about our sex life. Like, let's talk about fantasies together, and then, yes, build up. I think that's great advice. So I have a question for you about the sexual imprinting theory about men at a young age, how there's a certain period where their hormones are surging and they're, you know, teens, and that they find it harder, you say, to kind of develop beyond that, some men, beyond that imprinting phase. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so this is a theory that some psychologists believe might explain why men seem to have a somewhat more fixed sexuality than women, in the sense that once they develop a specific interest, it's hard for it to change, and it's hard for them to develop and learn new interests.
Mm-hmm.
Not everyone buys into this idea, and this is not to say that every man has a fixed sexuality.
Right.
You know, there are some men who are very fluid and flexible, and, you know, things are changing, their desires are changing throughout their lives. But, you know, the basic idea is sort of that it seems that something is going on with some people that just makes it hard for them to develop new sexual interests as they get older. It could be related to hormone levels and something that's happening in the brain. We don't fully understand it.
But can they? Like, is there a way to, can you reprogram your brain if it almost becomes a fetish? Let's say you're always fantasizing about threesomes, but you literally can't have sex. You can't not do that. Like, is it, can you learn tactics to kind of undo that?
Yeah. So that's where it gets really challenging, is can you unlearn a sexual interest that maybe you don't want anymore? Or, you know, maybe you just want to, you know, expand and try and develop more interests that you and your partner have in common. This is a, you know, kind of tough and challenging thing. We do know, though, that people can develop new interests. There's some really fascinating research showing that you can actually condition people in a lab setting to develop kinks and fetishes, right?
Yeah.
So if you pair a sexually arousing stimulus with a neutral one, so for example, if you show men images of boots just before you show them images of nude women, we're talking about heterosexual men here,
right.
Those men, over time, when you pair those stimuli, will eventually start to show arousal in response to the boot alone.
Uh-huh.
And we have studies and data demonstrating this. So, you know, there are ways that you can learn new interests if you take these sort of basic conditioning processes in psychology.
That's so interesting. Yeah, because, you know, if people are just tormented, they're like, I can't get out of it. I want to expand my sexual horizons, but all I can do is think about a shoe, you know? So, what do our sexual fantasies, like, say about our personalities, or what can our personalities tell us about our fantasies? I love how you break this all down in the book. People should just read this, because you're like, oh, no. It's very comforting too. You're like, now I get it. You know, I was raised in this certain environment with my parents, or I had sexual trauma even, or my first sexual experience, I mean, it went a certain way. And all these things, you're in your 15 questions, the way you answer them can really indicate why you are who you are, why you fantasize the way you do, or why you have certain desires.
Yeah, and that's what I was getting back to earlier, is that our fantasies are this unique reflection of who we are and where we are in our lives right now. And so our personalities contribute to that, our sexual histories and early sexual experiences, and also our age, and you know, all these things come together. I think the personality findings are among the most interesting.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
If you
I
look
found
at,
this fascinating. Okay.
Yeah, if you look at what's called the Big Five theory of personality, the idea here is that everybody's personality can be broken down into these five basic factors. One of them is openness to experience, which basically means you like to try new things. And if you're someone who is high in openness in real life, you're pretty high in openness in your sex fantasies, where you're wanting to try all kinds of new things. If you're high in the trait of agreeableness, which is having a lot of care and concern for others, in your sex fantasies, you have a lot more focus on your partner's pleasure.
Right.
If you're somebody who's high in the trait of conscientiousness, where you're very detail-oriented in the real world, you're detail-oriented in your fantasies, and you pay more attention to the setting and so forth. And if you're somebody who is high in neuroticism, where you get stressed out very easily, you tend to have more calming emotional content in your sexual fantasies. And also, if you're someone who's high in extroversion, meaning you're really outgoing and sociable in real life, you tend to want to have an outgoing sex life in your fantasies with multi-partner and non-monogamy fantasies. So we very much make our fantasies about ourselves.
Right, which makes total sense. I think, again, reading through this book and answering these questions for yourself can give people so much comfort. I feel like it'll be so, you're like, I get it. You're like, that's why. It just kind of like this light goes off. But by reading this, I just love that it gives people so many great tools to kind of feel that self-acceptance, and then just so they can go out and, have their group sex. So a question for you about the difference between, you spent a lot of time on the difference between sexual orientation and sexual flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
And that women seem to have greater sexual flexibility than men, which is kind of, like the Kinsey scale. We kind of know women sort of seem to be more flexible. We're not talking about, that's all orientation, but just in what they're going to try. So can you tell me about, maybe a little bit about that for our listeners?
Yeah. So women seem to be somewhat more flexible with regard to the gender of their partners.
Mm-hmm.
So women are more likely to have same-sex fantasies than men. But men are flexible in other ways. So, for example, men are more flexible when it comes to sort of playing with their gender role and expression. So, for example, men have more cross-dressing fantasies. They're more likely to fantasize about being in the body of the other sex or having sex with a transgender partner. So we see that men and women both have flexibility, but it comes out in sort of somewhat different ways in their sexual fantasies, which I think is really fascinating.
Yeah, I thought that was fascinating too. Let's talk about too now, because when we talk about the cross-dressing, there were certain people, like if they were like your religious background and also Democrat versus Republican, the fantasies too.
Right.
Weren't they more likely to cross-dress on one side or something?
So there were lots of interesting connections
I think,
between our political affiliations and our sexual fantasies.
Yes.
There was one with the sort of cross-dressing, gender-bending fantasies, but I suspect that might be driven partially by people who are more gender fluid to begin with,
right.
Might be more drawn to the Democratic Party because it's more tolerant of gender diversity. So I don't know how meaningful that association is.
Okay.
But some of the things I did find that were really interesting about politics were that Republicans had a lot more of the taboo interests across the board. They were fantasizing more about orgies and infidelity and exhibitionism, voyeurism, almost any taboo you can think of, Republicans were more likely to fantasize about, whereas Democrats were more likely to fantasize about BDSM and about passion and romance sort of scenarios. So there were some interesting political differences there that I saw.
I thought that was very interesting, and it kind of is aligned to what we've learned on the show here. So let's talk about taboo for a minute, because, and this might seem very like basic, but I want to understand this. And for my listeners, we always say, well, people love anal because it's taboo, or we love anything that's taboo, voyeurism, exhibitions, if anything that's just sort of outside, that's not missionary and doggy style. Can you explain this though, really like psychologically, why we are so drawn to these taboos?
Yeah, the appeal of the taboo stems largely from this psychological theory called reactance, which is basically meaning that whenever we're told we can't do something, it just makes us want to do it more, because when we perceive our personal freedoms as threatened, we sort of react, we rebel. And we see this all the time in our lives. And in fact, this is something a lot of us know as reverse psychology. You know, right. When you tell people you can't do something, it makes them want to do it even more. That's just sort of this characteristic of human nature, and it seems to be true sexually.
Yeah.
You know, that when our sexual freedom is threatened, we respond sort of by saying, okay, well, I'm going to want that even more.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it makes sense when you say it out loud. It's like, oh, people are like, but why would I want that? Yeah, you're right. You tell me no, I'm going to want to have anal or whatever. I will want to do it.
Whatever it is.
Whatever their person, whatever their big, whatever their fantasies are. So we know now, right? Most porn is made for men by men, right? The male gaze.
Right.
Do you believe if there was more porn made by women for women, that women would watch just as much porn as men?
I don't know if they would watch just as much, but I believe they would probably watch more than they do now. You know, it's interesting when you look at porn research, you know, you see exactly what you're talking about, which is that the current crop of porn that's made seems to be more appealing to men. And so that leads women to tend to gravitate toward other means of sexual fulfillment. And I think that's sort of fed into this broader perception that women are less visually aroused than men are. But I know a lot of researchers who don't believe that's the case. And in fact, when they show women in a lab setting pornography, they're showing high levels of genital arousal. And,
right.
So it's not necessarily the case that women are less visually aroused. I think it's just so far we haven't had enough visual content there that's appealing to women. And then there's also been, you know, sort of more shame and stigma attached to women seeking out sexual material than men. You know, we expect that men are going to do that, but not women. So
exactly.
I think if the social scripts changed a bit, we might see women.
I think so too, because women look it up and they're like, this isn't appealing to me. Like, I'm not interested in what's happening on the screen. So if there's more for women or for everyone else, it just seems like it's a very specific group that all this porn's made for. What if someone has a darker fantasy though? Like, what about these fantasies that were it's just, you know, they feel like it's dark and they're shame. What do you tell them? What does that tell them? Like a master and slave, right? Or a really just wanting to be hurt and abused, or, you know, things like that. Like what kind of work do they have to do in that first? Like, it could tie into some psychological trauma or just abuse.
Yeah. So I do find that some people who have a history of sexual victimization do have fantasies about very extreme forms of BDSM. I want to be very clear that, you know, this is the small link, and, you know, not everybody who has these fantasies has a history of sexual trauma or victimization. But for some people, that link is there. And I think that suggests that maybe the fantasies are a way that people are sort of coming to terms with the previous trauma that they've experienced. So again, our fantasies can be therapeutic in some ways, and we see that people cope with it in different ways. So some people with a history of victimization may have fantasies about having a lot of reassurance and validation. You know, they're looking for calming emotional content, whereas others, taking their fantasy off in a very different direction than that, where maybe the fantasy is totally emotionless and they're disconnecting from the experience, dissociating almost.
Right.
So that's another way that I think our fantasies are really fascinating.
Right. I think so too. And I think it's good to know that a lot of women who feel guilt around having, whether they've been traumatized or not, and I want to talk about this, the quote rape fantasy or being taken, you're desired so intensely that someone just has to have you. So the first point of that is there are people who have actually been raped or had trauma, and they can eroticize it in a healthy way. That can take some work, but I think they might have these fantasies and they feel really, it's just like through somatic therapy and stuff that I've heard about, that people can actually have a healthier connection, even if they do happen to fantasize about what they're, you can eroticize it in a healthy way, right? There's also healthy and unhealthy ways.
Right. Yeah. And I think, you know, there are healthy and unhealthy ways to deal with this, as you were saying. And I think it's really important when people are talking about, say, a forced sex fantasy,
to
sort of take that rape term out of it.
I know, I agree.
You know, it bears no resemblance to a real world rape. And I think that leads a lot of people to feel more guilt about these fantasies based on the way that they're labeling it. So, you know, when it's a fantasy, it's something where you're in total and complete control of that scenario. So it's, you know, bears no resemblance to
exactly.
A real world
that is such
assault.
Such a great distinction. I'm so glad you said that. And can you just explain the forced sex fantasy that so many people have and why? If they haven't been traumatized, even for example, like why it's so common and we have so much guilt around it. Can you explain where that comes from?
Yeah. So people very commonly fantasize about being taken against their will. And in fact, this is not something that's unique to women. I found about 2/3 of women reported having this fantasy before, but more than half of the men reported fantasies about, you know, a partner taking them against their will as well. So this cuts across gender lines, but it's somewhat more common in women. But I think that this fantasy most of the time stems from, you know, that sort of broader interest in BDSM that most people seem to have, where it's sort of a variant on dominance submission play, maybe sometimes with an element of masochism mixed in. Mm-hmm. But whatever it is that leads us to want BDSM is sort of, I think, what is driving a lot of this interest in simulated forced sex that occurs within, you know, in the fantasy. This is a very consensual activity. It's consensual non-consent.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. No, I love it. But it's true, though. BDSM comes up everywhere, and there's so many different ways to look at it. So I love how you break that down for people who are like, oh, it doesn't just have to look this way. We don't need a red room of pain. We're not Christian Grey. That's fine. You can create your own.
Right.
You can create your own wave of being dominant and submissive. Also, you talk about how sexual disorders are psychological and not so much physiological. And let's talk about that.
Sure, and that's an observation that, right? You know, we can trace back to Masters and Johnson, mm-hmm. Because they were really the pioneers of sex therapy in the United States. And, you know, one of their observations was really that, you know, most sexual disorders have psychological causes, and that you can solve a lot of them just by, you know, through some sort of behavioral treatment with the client rather than tinkering with their actual biology. And I think that this is something that's gotten lost in recent years.
Yeah.
People have forgotten about this. And increasingly, anytime we have a sex problem, we just want to take a pill. You know, we want our Viagra or our flibanserin or you know, whatever drug it is to solve our problem. But unfortunately, those drugs don't fix the underlying psychological issues that are creating a lot of these sexual problems. And a lot of them can be solved just by having better communication with your partner and getting rid of that sex shame.
Right, exactly. And it just starts with the talk. If people are ready to communicate with a partner, but they want to talk to a therapist about this or to kind of figure it out, would you suggest like a sex therapy or for trauma? Like, what do you think about EMDR? Are there practices that you have found to be really useful with helping people through sexual challenges?
So that's getting a little bit beyond, you know, kind of what I do. So I'm not actually a sex therapist.
Right.
I'm trained as a social psychologist. I'm a researcher. So I don't actually practice therapy on the front lines. I can't speak as much to, you know, which therapies are most or least effective. But, you know, what I would refer people to if they have, you know, sexual issues where they're looking for help is to try to find a therapist who is certified through this group called ASECT. That's an acronym for the American Association of Sexuality Counselors, Educators, and Therapists. It's kind of a mouthful.
I know. But, ASECT. Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
But yeah, they're a great group. You can go to their website and, you know, find a therapist that's in your area. And if they're certified by this group, odds are that, you know, they're going to have the right tools and training to help you.
Okay. Thank you. Very helpful. You've been working at the Kinsey Institute for how long now? You've been doing this for a long time.
Yeah. So I've been a sex researcher for the last 10 years, and I've been with Kinsey for the last couple of years. What initially got me into it was in graduate school, I was a teaching assistant for a human sexuality course, and that course just opened my eyes to the whole world of sex research. You know, I didn't even know it existed before then, but that's what sort of stimulated my initial interest, and ever since then, I've been studying, researching, writing, talking about sex every day, and my job very much now is, you know, kind of being a communicator, a translator of science for the public, because I don't think we have enough of us who are doing that and giving people the scientifically based information that they want and deserve.
Yeah, they're really not. And you're doing such great, you've done such great work for people here. I think that this, especially in this book, the book just came out, right?
Yeah, it came out this summer.
Okay, yep. This summer. So what's the response been like? Really, I want to ask, like, what the most surprising thing that you kind of talked about this openly, what at the top of the show, what was the most surprising thing that you found in here that you were like, there's no way, I can't believe this happened?
You mean the most surprising thing?
Yeah,
from the
thing
survey
that you found
itself?
From the survey, yeah.
I mean, there are a couple of things. I know we sort of covered this ground a little bit, but some of them were some of the findings that were inconsistent with previous research. So one was, you know, I found a link between previous sexual victimization and having fantasies about BDSM. And that's not something that has popped out in the literature before, and people have always said that this is a myth, but I find that there does seem to be something to it. It's a very small association, but you know, to me that was very surprising because it was just inconsistent with the previous research.
I know that you've been part of studies surrounding open relationships and polyamory, right? And so what do you think are the biggest misconceptions that people have about these kind of relationships?
Mm-hmm. There's so many. It's
I know exactly. Right. But you're the researcher scientist. I just tell people all the time, like, it's a lot. People like it works. It can be healthy, you know? And so you've done the research. So,
yeah. And I think one of the big ones is that, you know, people who open up their relationship in any way, it means that, you know, their relationship is bad and that, you know, they're only opening it up to try and save it. And, you know, that's not the case. We see that people can have consensually non-monogamous relationships and be very happy and healthy and satisfied. And just because you're maybe having multiple sexual or romantic partners, that doesn't mean that you're going to be any less into or less attracted to, you know, one of your other partners. In fact, we see that having multi-partner relationships, that can actually strengthen all of the relationships you have, because you're getting your needs fulfilled in, you know, sort of different places. So you're not putting all of that pressure on one person to meet every single need that you have. So I think there are some unique benefits of consensual non-monogamy that are often unrecognized or unrealized.
I think that's exactly what it is. Like, who made up this notion that should be with one person for the rest of our lives, going to take care of every single need? I mean, it does absolutely make sense that, actually, you know, when people give themselves permission and have great communication, it can work. But what I also like is, like, the people who do engage in more open relationships or non-monogamy, that they take that into the relationship, so it becomes like their own dirty talk, like talking about their past partners or something they did the night before. Can actually, it's a big part of it for a lot of couples or swingers, or just talking about what happened. People think, oh my God, I couldn't imagine sleeping with someone else, letting my partner, and like, let alone letting my partner know what happened. But really, this can be really hot fuel for people to kind of spice things up.
Right. And I think, you know, one of the concerns that a lot of people have is that, you know, jealousy is going to set in. But for a lot of people who are practicing consensual non-monogamy, we see that they don't really experience jealousy with their partners. And instead, many of them experience this emotion called compersion, where, you know, seeing their partner happy or hearing about their partner's pleasure makes you happy rather than making you feel threatened. Mm-hmm. I think another, you know, sort of misconception people have is that if you're in an open relationship, that you're going to have all kinds of STDs and, you know, that this is really risky for your health. And I did a study a couple of years ago where I compared STD rates for people who were consensually non-monogamous to people who were supposedly in monogamous relationships, and found that the rates of STDs didn't differ, which I thought was really fascinating.
That is fascinating.
It's explained by the fact that infidelity occurs very often in monogamous relationships, and infidelity is actually a really high-risk behavior, right? Because when people cheat on their partner, they're usually not planning on it, you know, so they're not prepared. They don't practice safe sex, and then they don't tell their partner about it, so their partner doesn't find out, and then, you know, then they're not having sex with their primary partner, and then they're spreading the STD, and no one's getting tested, and, you know, infidelity is very risky, but for people who practice consensual non-monogamy, they tend to be much more communicative about STDs and testing, and take more health precautions.
It's so true. And then, yeah, it's like a commitment to your partner in your consensual non-monogamous, that you will use condoms, that you will be respectful. So that makes so much sense. Thank you so much, Dr. Lehmiller. Yeah. Justin Lehmiller, this is, I love your book. I love all of your work. I've been following you for years. So I'm so happy to talk to you. Thank you for this interview. Do you have anything else coming up? And we're going to promote all of your stuff here, but anything else you'd like to share?
You know, I also run a blog called Sex and Psychology at sexandpsychology.com. I've been running it for the last 7 years, and I blog about the latest sex research several times a week. I'm also starting to do more public speaking, going around the country talking about the science of sex and relationships. So I'm happy to have people come out and see me, and all that information is on my website.
Okay, good. Well, I'd love to see if you come to Los Angeles. I'd love to meet you in person. That would be great.
Yeah, I think we're planning an event in LA. It'll probably be early next year, but I'll definitely let you know.
Okay, good. I would love to be there. And thank you for all this. Thank you, Justin Lehmiller. Tell me what you want. The Science of Sexual Desire and how it can help you improve your sex life. Thank you so much for your time, and I look forward to meeting you, and keep up the great work.
Thanks. It was great to talk
to you
finally.
You too. I know, really. Okay, have a great day. Thanks. Okay, guys, find him on Twitter at Justin Lehmiller. That's LehMiller, or on Instagram at Justin J. Lehmiller. Check out his awesome website, sexandpsychology.com. Tell me what you thought of the interview. I'd love to hear. You can send us an email, feedback@sexwithemily.com, or hit me up on social media. We always post it on Instagram and Twitter. I want to know what you think. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And thank you to my amazing team, Ken, Sarah, producer Jamie, and Michael. Was it good for you? Email me, feedback@sexwithemily.com.